Well, welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and we have a terrific show on tap for you today. Marv Albert, the Basketball Hall of Famer, the longtime NBA voice of TNT, NBC, of course, all his years with the New York Knicks, he joins me in studio, and we take a long look through one of the most decorated careers in sports broadcasting. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way to support it. Head over to Apple Podcast, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple. It's the best way to make sure we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. Well, Marv Albert has broadcast the Super Bowls, Stanley Cup Finals. He has worked championship tennis, even, I believe, a couple of World Series. But most people know him as the voice of the NBA for the last three decades, first with NBC and now with TNT. And he's kind enough to join me here in studio for the podcast. Marv, I know we've been talking about doing this for... It seems like since I saw you in Rio at the Olympics last year, we've been discussing getting you here in studio. So thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure, Chris. I know, yeah, in Rio, I actually lost my voice for a day or two, which actually might have been more interesting for the podcast. But no, I'm glad I'm able to finally do it.
A crazy
season. We've had more games than ever because they on TNT because they expanded the schedule.
Oh, no question. You mentioned that. I don't know what the word is, concerned about your voice at all times. Is that fair to say that, you know, when you see your schedule coming up, I mean, what's your preparation like just to care for the voice?
Well, I must say, when I work with people like Mike Pratello, the czar, I would always tell him I can't talk, so I would not have to go to dinner with him. But I do watch it very carefully because I find, and this is years ago this happened too, if I'm in a loud restaurant at night before the game, or if I'm talking too much, and I must say I never yelled at my kids. All I had to do was give a look to them. So that was good, and their mother took care of the rest. But I do lose my voice if I'm talking too much. Mm-hmm. So... This is fine because I don't have a game for a while, so this is okay. But I know other announcers and actors and actresses have the same concern, particularly singers. I won't put myself in that category, but I find I have to be very careful, and fortunately have a very good throat doctor who sees me every so often. So, yeah, so one of the perils of doing games that take 2.5-3 hours on a regular basis.
You got started in this business, Marv, in the early 1960s, right? I mean,
kind of, yeah. Well, full time in the mid 1960s, but I started out because I had gotten to know Marty Glickman, who was the voice of every sport in New York City, and was the voice of the Knicks and the Giants football. You know, some of your older fans would be more aware of Marty, but he was just a great announcer. And I got to know him because I was a ball boy for the Knicks at one point, and then ended up keeping statistics for Marty. And I was at Syracuse and then for 3 years, and he offered me a job as his writer. He was at CBS Radio, WCBS Radio, locally in New York, and was doing regular sports shows and was doing the games on CBS. So I would be his writer and backup announcer. I had been doing sports probably from the third grade on via my tape recorder off television sets. But I had worked in Syracuse as a rock and roll disc jockey, although I always wanted to be a sportscaster from the third grade on. And Marty had heard my tapes, and I'd gotten to know him pretty well. He was like a second father to me. So back to your question, yes, in the early 60s, while I was finishing up school at NYU, I actually did my first Knick and Ranger games because of conflicts that Marty had and the Rangers announcer at the time, Jim Gordon, had. So it was at a very early stage, and I listened to some of these tapes, and I say, how did they put me on the air?
Just to go back to that, it was that Marty was stuck in a snowstorm, I believe I read. Was he in Paris or something? I was reading an SI story about this from the early 1990s on you and your family. And you were at the Boston Garden trying to...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Marty also did harness racing at Yonkers Raceway and was on harness racing business in Paris. And it was a snowstorm, although I still feel, and I used to tell him and he would deny it, that on purpose he said he couldn't get back, so I would get an opportunity. The Knicks played the Celtics in Boston. It was a just a ferocious snowstorm in the East. So I went up at the last minute on an all-night train ride with my brother, Al, who also was a broadcaster, and you know, later on. He was my statistician, and we, you know, stayed over for 3 hours at a hotel in Boston, and then had to prove to the people at the press gate that we were actually doing the game. I was like 19, 20 yeah. years old, and did not look like I was the broadcaster, but I took my commercials out of the briefcase to try and prove it, and they finally did let me in. And the Knicks were pretty bad at that time, mm-hmm. too, I should say. And the Celtics were very good, which is not a surprise. So it was a rout, but you know, what a thrill to do it, particularly at the Boston Garden, which had one of the greatest broadcast booth, I would say, you know, in terms of vantage point in the history of the NBA.
That was right there on the floor, right?
Where... No, we're actually on a over the floor.
Okay.
It was similar to the old Madison Square Garden where I started. Had the same thing also. It was very, but it was like very, very close to the floor or to the ice in terms of hockey.
I don't think people realize just how big a hellhole the old Boston Garden was. I mean, I grew up in Boston. I went there a lot as a kid, and I remember having some of the obstructed view seats. I remember it being like 1,000 degrees in there for, I mean, in the old stories of players and what they had to deal with in that god-awful visiting locker room. How many stories over the years did you hear from players and what happened in Boston?
Oh, I spent time in the locker room because when I eventually ended up doing the Knicks on a regular basis, we'd always use, we'd be in the locker room to leave our coats and our luggage or whatever. It was the old Red Auerbach. Red was responsible for making certain that the visiting locker room had either very hot, scorching showers or ice cold. It was not a pleasant place to be. Lockers were very small. I don't think the cleaning crew dealt with the visiting locker room. And it's funny, I got to know Red very well over the years because he was very close to Marty. They're both Brooklyn guys, mm-hmm. as I am. And he was just, you know, wonderful to talk to. And I think the book by John Feinstein, mm-hmm. That really captured,
I read that.
His, you know, he had a group of friends he'd meet up with every week. Mm-hmm. He had great stories. But if you were a visitor, in terms of being a visiting team, it was not a pleasant experience. In fact, the Lakers, for one of the finals, Pat Riley had them dress back at the hotel. So they wouldn't have to deal with the locker room. And they came, I remember they came off the bus and they were fully dressed, had their own soap with them. You know, this was like Pat Riley's strategy. He knew in advance he better to make things a little bit more pleasant for the Lakers.
See, and I always wondered about whether the Red Auerbach stuff with the showers, whether it was real or whether it was kind of a wives' tale, because I was a ball boy too with the Celtics.
You were.
I was for about 8 years.
But what, it was what the, era was that?
ML Carr and 95, 90, basically right. 95, when they were really bad, just when they moved into the new building. And I was actually the visiting locker room guy. Like, I worked the visiting locker room right. about 6 years there. And I would always kind of ask some of the older guys, like, did this, and they weren't that much older, but like, did this really happen? Because I never saw that in the new building. I assume that was more of a Red Auerbach thing in the old building.
It was. The new building is better, not sensational when you see locker rooms
sure.
in other cities. But yeah, that it was. Actually, I started as a visiting ball boy and then worked myself up. What a great ball boy discussion.
I thought the visiting with more money in it there, Marv.
That's
I mean,
right,
I had the cash there in the back.
You are correct. Yeah. That's right.
And I lived on college off that money.
And sometimes you were getting good tips then. Mm-hmm. As sometimes the coach would let you stay when he'd be doing his pregame whatever, things were not as involved as they are now. It's mm-hmm. completely different. I mean, it was really, there was no such thing as an assistant coach in the earlier days, and it was just the head coach primarily. And there were even player coaches, which is hard to fathom now. But the best thing about being a ball boy is we would be able to come early to Madison Square Garden or way back at the 69th Regiment Armory where the Knicks would play some games when the circus was in town. And we could play ball mm-hmm. on the court. What a thrill that was, you know, with the glass backboards, et cetera. So that was a lot of fun.
I did that too with the it was the same parquet that they had at the Fleet Center,
the
TD
best.
Garden.
And
I used to come at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a game day and play 5-on-5 with the other ball boys.
Was dribble affected by the dead spots on the floor?
I looked for it. I didn't. No? Maybe it's because I wasn't all that good, so it didn't play into it. But your relationship with Red over the years, I mean, from your perspective, what made him such a basketball genius? You've been around Phil Jackson. You've been around all the greats. What separated Red?
I think, although on a more simplified basis, it's very similar to how well Steve Kerr has done with Golden State, except things now are certainly at a different level in terms of setting up plays and with analytics. But they were so great with people. Mm-hmm. And they both had a terrific sense of humor. I mean, Red didn't show it to outsiders, but he was very funny. Mm-hmm. And the players appreciated the way he handled them. With Steve, it's the same. And Steve had no coaching experience. Mm-hmm. But he was with me for 4 years at Turner doing color, and he was terrific. And then he was general manager of the Suns and did very well. They went to the Western Conference Finals, and then he left and came back. We told him we were keeping the seat warm. And then he got the job with Golden State. And, you know, people were questioning, hey, he has no experience, although they respected him as a player, but he hadn't coached. But he, under the, tutelage, or he was very close with Greg Popovich and Phil Jackson. And, you know, he was a guy who really studied quite a bit and had the experience in terms of dealing with people. Is nobody like Steve. I mean, mm-hmm. he's so well-liked, but he's also, so smart, just the way he handles things. So I think there was a lot of that in Red in a different way, sometimes more gruff, but I think that's part of it. And he, like Steve, had the players. Mm-hmm. And also Red was ahead of his time in terms of, you know, it used to be you would scout players through Street and Smith's college basketball yearbook. There was very little scouting, but Red had people all over the country. He had contacts, and so he was able to find and knew the greatness of Bill Russell. I mean, you know, Bill Russell wasn't seen on television. There weren't scouts going to see him, and he made the trade involving Ed mm-hmm. McCauley, et cetera, Cliff Hagan. But I think that was part of it. You could be ahead of the game if you had the right contacts, and you look at some, they were lucky with a coin flip they got Bob Cousy. This is going way back because the league was still in its formative stage. But I think the way he put his team together also had a lot to do with it. He was so far ahead of other teams in the NBA.
There's a church and state feeling with media and teams now where there's almost a big wall, but it wasn't like that early on in your career, was it? There's a lot of interaction.
Yeah. In fact, you had a situation where you had, and as you know, journalism was so different in every sport, and you had writers who were very close to the coach and to some of the players. I mean, I remember when the Knicks, the great Knick teams of, you know, 69-70, the two championship teams, and then 72-73, you had writers who were very close to Red Holzman. So as a result, you didn't have the kind of coverage that you have today where Red would tell people things, and it happened in baseball and hockey also and in football, and it would not be printed. Today, it's incredibly different. Certainly with social media now, but even prior to social media in the 70s, in the 80s and the 90s, they became a little, wary of things getting out. So that changed. But, you know, like Red Holzman, for example, would play cards with the writers mm-hmm. and would go to dinner with the writers. You just don't see that anymore. It's more protective now mm-hmm. in every way. So that was the major difference. I mean, the writers went on the charters. You do not see that. I mean, the broadcasters usually went on the charters, mm-hmm. but the writers did not. Mm-hmm. So it was really separation.
Have you ever gone back and listened to that 60 Celtic Nick game, your fill-in debut?
You know, I heard the tape a long time ago, and it was a different sound. But when I was first starting out in broadcasting, because I was around Marty Glickman so frequently, I was talking like him. Even I'd answer the phone at home. Like, and Marty had a very distinctive way about him. And I think I got my parents crazy with that. I mean, I didn't even realize I was doing it. And then the most important thing for a young broadcaster is to develop his own style. I mean, I was influenced by the fact that he really set the geography of the court, and I started out primarily doing radio, and he was mostly on radio. And you always knew where the ball was, or in hockey, where the puck was. And it was important to get those particular geographical areas correct. It's on the right sideline. It's along the baseline. It's what kind of shot is it? Is it a running one-hander? Is it a jump shot from 20? Is he cutting to his left? Is it a backdoor pass on the bounce? I mean, this is more radio than TV. And in TV, you pull back, I feel. You should pull back. I mean, you see quite a bit of it, but you don't have to talk as much. And you're also setting up the color man, particularly in basketball. Hockey is more of a play-by-play sport because it's so fast and there's so few commercial breaks. But that's what I gained from being around Marty Glickman as much as I was, because just in sitting with him and watching him capture the game, I thought there was no one like him at that time.
In coming up, as you said, with your own style, is it just trial and error as you're going through, these jobs, and or are you working on stuff at home at the same time? I mean, how are you formulating that personal style?
It's a bit of trial and error, and I used to listen to every possible broadcast. I mean, I remember on my shortwave radio, particularly with hockey, and hockey was very big where I grew up in Brooklyn. We had roller hockey leagues. As it turns out, my son played hockey and ended up playing for a club team at NYU. And my brother Al, who ended up doing the Denver Nuggets and Indiana Pacers and did Nets briefly in New York, but he was a hockey nut, and he would travel. And it's hard to find ice time in Brooklyn, but he would travel an hour several times a week, and he became a very good skater, became a goaltender, played in college, and then actually made a minor league team. The Toledo Blades now, I believe they are. He was the backup goaltender and got in once in a while, and when his goals against average went up to 16.21, he decided perhaps broadcasting was the better way to go, and he did. He ended up, doing hockey and basketball.
You, I read somewhere that there was one game where you, Al, and Steve were all doing a broadcast. I think it was at the Garden, where USA Network was involved. The Nets, it was a Knicks Nets game at the Garden. All in the family, right there.
It's kind of annoying, actually. But yes, they were there. Al was doing the early cable national package was on USA Network, and he and Hubie Brown did the games, and Steve, I forgot which team, Steve, he may have been doing the Nets at the time, and I was doing the Knicks. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's happened. It's happened many times where I would do a national game, either NBC or Turner, and either Al or Steve were doing the game. Now it's exclusive with TNT, so it doesn't happen, but that happened quite a few times. Yeah, and with my son Kenny, too, that's happened.
I was at my radio show, I was talking to Sean Waynes recently, and his family, all comedians, Keenan Ivory Waynes, Damon, they're all, and he was just telling me, when one does it, we all kind of follow suit. You with a family of broadcasters, does everyone kind of chart their own path, or is there a common thread where one does something and you guys kind of follow the leader in some ways?
Well, it really became a situation where they saw what I was doing, and boy, this is fun. And when I first started out in New York radio on WHN, which is now WFAN, moved down the dial to WNBC and the WFAN, Al worked as an intern for me when he was in college and when I was first starting out. And then Steve did the same, but we never thought that I knew Al would go into it. Never thought Steve would. I thought he'd be a puppeteer traveling the country. But he also took to it and became, very good at it. And it's a great way, as you know, it's a great way to make a living. You're having fun and you're around, for the most part, terrific people. And it's something you have to really have the passion for it. And I can recall telling my third grade teacher, Mrs. Lepowski, when we had to write the usual paper, what do you want to be when you grow up, that I would like to be a broadcaster for the Knicks and the Rangers. I mean, network I'd never thought about, and would like to write a column for the New York Times. So It was two out of three that did work out, fortunately. So.
Pretty good. Most people don't get two out of three when they're third grade. You know, you were in New York when Phil Jackson was playing there early on. When you were around Phil at that time, did you get any sense then, either through just his mind or how he operated, that, you know, we might be seeing what could eventually become a historically great coach and now an executive?
I don't think anyone saw it. It was a different Phil in many ways at that time. And he was a solid player. He was one of these guys similar to Bill Cartwright, who would hurt his own players in practice because he had the sharp elbows by accident. Mm-hmm. And would be very, very physical. And Phil was a very good player off the bench. But as in terms of coaching, that was not something any of us saw. I thought he would end up perhaps as the movie critic for the Village Voice or something more artsy, you know. But I think when he was injured, he actually, on the 69-70 Knick Championship team, did not play. He was sidelined by injury. He sat with Red Holzman on the bench quite a bit. Also, we got interested in photography through the Knicks official photographer, George Kolinsky. Mm. And he and George put a book together because Phil was taking photos along the baseline during the playoffs. And that book is available, Chris, if you'd like. I happen to have a copy.
You have a copy?
At home. But I think it was really spending a lot of time with Red Holzman, and perhaps he wasn't really sure what he wanted to do, and then realized, hey, this is what I would like to do, and ended up in the CBA with the Albany Patroons. Mm-hmm. And I remember he'd come to the Garden, you know, on off nights when the Knicks were playing and Albany was off, get the free meal at the press room, and then would, you know, come to the games. And then it started to evolve that this is what he was going to do. It took a little while, and then Jerry Krause hired him in Chicago as an assistant under Doug Collins.
You had talked about Steve Kerr and the comparisons he might have to a Red Auerbach and what makes Steve Kerr successful. From watching Phil over the years as a coach, I mean, the system worked. Having great players obviously certainly helps. But what was it that made him a great coach? I always say that coaching superstars is not easy. If it was, a lot more people than like a handful would have rings right now. What was it about Phil that you saw made him such a great coach?
Well, I wasn't around him as a coach as much as I have been with Steve or mm-hmm. when I saw what Red Holzman or Red Auerbach did. But he handled the players extremely well. And as you mentioned, he had many superstars, and that's always tough. He was a bit more talkative in Los Angeles than he has been in New York as a general manager the last 3.5-4 years. But I always felt, from what I saw, and we did a lot of Laker games at the time when NBC had the package, if he was upset with a player or felt they should be doing something different, he would actually make his point through the newspapers. Mm-hmm. It was very calculated as to what he would say. And he might annoy Kobe and Shaq. But that's, to me, that's the way he would talk to him. And he was very direct, but I just think he handled things extremely well. And he had good people around him on the bench. And I think developed into, as you say, one of the great coaches of all time.
There was back in the day, there was a connectedness that you had to the players, like we talked about, being around them more, flying on the charters, a closeness. Did you ever, I mean, how often, if at all, did you have guys, you know, coming up to you, talking about how you portrayed them on the broadcast or you know, what your commentary was during a game?
Or being annoyed, you mean?
Yes.
About the comment? Yeah, that would have, it didn't happen too often, and I always felt you had to be objective and of doing the Knicks and the Nets. You had to say what was going on, because if you didn't and things were really good, why are people going to believe you when giving positive information. I know that's not always the theory with teams outside of the big cities or outside of New York, but I always felt it was very important if they're not playing well, you have to say that so-and-so is not playing well. I rarely heard from players. One time or more than once where I would hear from either managers or players who were upset was when I was doing the baseball pregame show on NBC. And it was kind of an edgy show, and there were people who became upset and wouldn't go on the show, mm-hmm. you know. So that did occur. Mm-hmm. But from players, I knew if they were upset. But, you know, when I was doing the Knicks in the early days, they were so good that they rarely played poorly. So I, you know, I never experienced that. In later years, I mean, I knew management was upset. That's one of the reasons that I – not doing, you know, the Knicks at this point, or I mean, I wouldn't be doing them now anyway because doing the TNT games is enough at this stage. But the Knick management was affected, you know, by let's say objectivity, and even to the point when I was doing their TV, the feeling was don't talk too much about the opposition team, which was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, focus on the Knicks, who were really bad at the time also. So there's not much of a story there if you're just doing that, particularly if Michael Jordan's coming in, or, you know, with Scottie Pippen of the Bulls, or, you know, Hakeem Olajuwon is coming in with the Rockets, or whoever would be a Bird in the Celtics. So that was difficult, but I just kept on broadcasting the way I always did. I mean, in the days of Dave Checketts and Bob Gutkowski prior to Jim Dolan, that was never a problem.
Mm-hmm. The Dolan family has owned the Knicks for a long time. How different was your relationship with Charles versus what it was with Jim?
You mean his father? Charles?
His father, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Charles was in the background, but I don't think anybody really had a relationship. But I remember he was a very nice man, and he was, as it turns out, very close with Marty Glickman, because Charles Dolan started HBO. Mm-hmm. And Marty was one of the early people to work for HBO. So Charles Dolan really was not hands-on at Madison Square Garden. I mean, in terms of, you know, people who did the games. But it was different when Jim Dolan took over. And it was quiet at the start. And then, you know, he felt things had to be done a certain way and did not want to hear anything what he considered negative, but what I would consider objective. So that, you know, mm-hmm. there you have it.
He was very hands-on, and still is very hands-on.
Oh, no question.
Was it a shock in some ways, going through all those years of not having that sort of hands-on from an ownership perspective to going to Jim, who really changed the culture? And you can argue better or worse. I mean, most people would argue worse. But, you know, was very hands-on there.
Well, yeah, I think that's been a problem with forget about the broadcasting end, but I think it's a problem in terms of trades that have been forced upon general managers. And I thought, for example, when Donnie Walsh was with the Knicks, I thought he was on the right track. And I know that Donnie was not particularly happy there when moves were not made or were made that were not his decisions.
Rhymes and, with Schmarmelo Schmanthony.
That would be one of them. I thought with Carmelo, and I understand, obviously, you want to make as much money as you possibly can, but I thought he, with a contending team, even now, if any that may happen, would be terrific coming off the bench as instant offense, if he'd accept that. And at this stage, he should and could win a championship in the NBA because he's a tremendous offensive player. But it has to be where it's 30 minutes, 25 minutes. Doesn't have to worry about – and he can play defense. I mean, it's that you have to want to play defense, as you know. Mm-hmm. But strictly as an explosive shooter, he would have a different finish to his career.
I felt this growing up in Boston, that there was a certain type of player that couldn't play in a town like Boston, that the pressure cooker that sports market was, some people just couldn't handle it. In different sports, doesn't have to be basketball, but I saw example after example over the years of guys that didn't do it. When did you see that with the Knicks, maybe guys that couldn't handle the teeth of a market like that with the number of outlets covering you, the tabloids, and just how vicious they could be at times when you weren't playing well?
Yeah, so some of the players, the ones who were on the Knicks championship teams, I think loved the attention. You're talking about Walt Clyde Frazier, particularly. Earl Monroe was a low-key guy, but he was terrific with all the guys were, DeBuscher and Bradley and Willis Reed. And they were, even before they became huge winners, they were always, it wasn't the same kind of press coverage that you have now, but they were the darlings of New York sports and became pretty well known nationally also because it was such an attractive team and you see how these guys have done after basketball. But yeah, I would think there are certain guys who probably, both in the NHL and the NBA, and you see it in baseball too, who if things aren't going well and they get knocked, I think they are affected.
Can you believe it's been as long as it has? I mean, as somebody that covered the Knicks championship years, it's been as long as it has since the Knicks have won an NBA championship.
Well, they had another shot against the Rockets in the 90s. And, you know, certainly that was a good Rocket team, but those were the years that Michael was playing baseball. So Chicago had a two-year hiatus and then got right back to it when Jordan returned. But, yeah, the organization has made bad moves, particularly in recent years when you look at playoffs or lack of thereof or getting to the second round, and it's it just shouldn't happen for that. It should not be that kind of drought. Mm-hmm. And also it has to be a destination that other players want to come to, and that is not the case right now. I mean, it's really not a good situation. And I think it's difficult for this particular organization to correct that. Mm-hmm. It could be a long time.
Yeah, unfortunately. You had a great job from when you took over the Knicks and going through it. When did you decide that you wanted to go national, that you wanted, I mean, the opportunity with NBC obviously came up. When did that sort of become something you wanted?
Well, I was doing the 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock sports at Channel 4, WNBC in New York, and I was asked if I would like to take a crack at boxing and college basketball because they didn't have the NBA at the time. So I started out doing college basketball on Saturdays and would end up subbing for Dick Enberg if he had a conflict. So I'd work with Al McGuire, which was terrific. Mm-hmm. That was he's one of the most unforgettable characters I've ever worked with. And then I ended up doing boxing. Don Ohlmeyer was there before Dick Ebersole, so I started out with Don, who was the executive producer, and then Dick later on. And it wasn't something I was looking to, although, you know, it was certainly on my mind, hey, that'd be great. And I remember the first preseason NFL meeting that all the announcers came to, and I'm sitting in the room in my first year with Kurt Gowdy, Dick Enberg, Charlie Jones. I'm looking around and I said, I can't believe that I'm sitting here. You know, it really hit me then. And there were several other guys there too that, you know, I had grown up listening to when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, those early years doing national, was it any different for you in terms of difficulty in stepping into that role where you're outside of the Knicks sort of umbrella?
I think I changed my style a little bit, but I always have felt you have to have kind of a light sense of humor, you know, along with it, which I was able to keep with it's important to me who I'm working with, and it has to be, I always felt I'm more effective with guys who have a sense of humor and get it or make fun of me, you know, also. And
that's what made you and Fratello so good over the years.
Mike is a walking punching bag, which I enjoy, but he's, you know, terrific in terms of being an analyst, and also is very funny. And Steve Kerr too also has had a great sense of humor. And the other guys, I mean Reggie Miller and Chris Webber, etc. I've enjoyed working with, and Brent Barry, who has a very low key sense of humor, as you know. But I think that when I first started out, it's when you do network, if it's an NFL game, it's different when you're broadcasting to a hometown audience because you take for granted they know a little bit more information about the players and also about tendencies, and it's different on the national level. I think you have to be, particularly when you're jumping from team to team every Sunday or every Saturday, I think there are things you would say or anecdotes you'd use that you might not on a local broadcast of a Knick game or a Ranger game.
How long does it take you, and you've had a lot of broadcast partners over the years, how long does it take you to develop chemistry with a broadcast partner?
Some right away. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes in the off time, you know, that contributes to it. And sometimes it takes a little while to really get to know each other, particularly with humor, because it can be someone who might not get it, you know, at times, or maybe I don't get it, you know, by trying to have them get it. So you kind of feel your way through it. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to say, you know, this is a comedy show, but I think it's important to, and if you make a mistake, to be able to kind of make light of it. You know, I do. I remember working with Bill Parcells, who that was a great experience. I worked NBC NFL games with Bill, and he would always say if a producer would come up with some kind of graphic where it would be of humor, perhaps at the cost of Bill, he would always say, what is this, Milton Berle we're doing here? You know, so you know, he'd have this. He'd have a reference to someone of the 50s usually, but Bill was very funny. Mm-hmm. And it was great getting to know him because his knowledge in other sports, we used to play NBA initials all the time, and he was really good. He prepared for it too. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd go to the practice on a Friday or Saturday morning, and he'd be prepared with obscure names, and he'd be very annoyed if I or anybody else on the crew would come up with the correct answer.
I always think it's, and I've been lucky growing up in the Northeast and now, you know, watching national basketball locally. I think Mike Gorman's one of the very best doing
Absolutely.
It right now, been doing
yep.
it for 3+ decades. Mike Breen here in New York, and
right.
I've joked with them in the past about their signature, you know, lines are, you know, two words tops. I mean, Mike Gorman says got it and that's his, and Breen is bang, and you for you is just the yes. I mean, I know you've told this story before, but the advent of yes becoming your kind of catch line there.
It was accidental that when I'd be playing ball in the schoolyards of Brooklyn, a friend of mine from high school, there'd always be a guy who's doing play by play as you're playing 3-on-3. It wasn't me. I was kind of shy. So he would actually do the play by play as we're playing. And there was a referee by the name of Sid Borgia. In fact, his son Joe is now the supervisor of officials for the NBA. Yes. But Sid was a very colorful referee and would go yes, and it counts if a guy would like bank it home and would be fouled. So in the act, so he'd go to the line for a free throw. And my friend would always go yes on shots in the schoolyard. And for some reason, I remember the game it happened. It was a Knicks-Philadelphia game at the Garden. Dick Barnett hit a fallback baby, one of his specialties, jump shot that banked home, and I happened to say yes. And then I just started to use it once in a while, and I saw it was being repeated back to me by fans or by players. So that's how it started. But the players would always, you know, even in practice, they – if I'm there, or even if I'm not, I'm told they, you know, they do that all the time. So
you're a shy kid. How do you get over the shy kid part of it? Because you can't be shy as a broadcaster. When does that change for you?
It's a way of shedding the shyness, mm-hmm. you know, releasing it, so to speak. And I always didn't have problems talking into a tape recorder. You know, mm-hmm. I bring a tape recorder to games at the Garden when I was ball boy. I was able to, for a college game, I would work it out to be able to sit in that broadcast perch and do games. I also, as a kid, I worked for the Brooklyn Dodgers mm-hmm. in the ticket office as a summer job. And one of the advantages of that, two tickets in the overhang, which was right next to the Dodger radio broadcast booth. It was the year before they moved to L.A. So they had Vince Scully there and Connie Desmond. And I, in fact, I'd go to the booth to pick up their commercials after they had left so I could use them on my fictitious radio station, WMPA, for my initials. So I did, you know, I was doing baseball games and annoying people in the booth who I was, it was usually Walter O'Malley family. So they actually moved me down the right field line, which I accepted very gracefully. I mean, I understood because I would always bring a friend or one of my brothers to do color. So it probably came out in terms of the shyness by, you know, doing stuff like that and being able to broadcast into my tape recorder. Then eventually when I was at Syracuse University, there were no sports announcing jobs available. But the great thing about Syracuse is that many of us were able to get jobs within the city on regular stations. So I did do the Syracuse Chiefs for a year as the second person on the broadcast. And I had to start out by doing something. So I was a rock and roll disc jockey, which was, I had a great time with it.
Did you get close to those Knicks players in the day? I mean, how friendly were you with some of those guys?
Well, because we traveled with them, Chris, we, you know, you'd sit with them on the plane. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, after games, they're tired and going to sleep. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you talk a lot to Bill Bradley. I was particularly friendly with Dave DeBuscher. And Willis and Clyde and Dick Barnett, Mike Reardon, who was a guy who came off the bench, played in played up in Providence, right?
Mm-hmm. Mike Reardon, yep.
Yeah. So, yeah, you would talk to the players quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Even in recent years, I found when I traveled, I did the Nets for 4 or 5 years, and we'd be on the plane and. I would end up talking to guys. You know, mm-hmm. they'd sit down. They had more questions for me about various games, and particularly the Jordan era, because mm-hmm. they were watching at that time. And that was a joy when NBC was doing the games because of the. I mean, now it's great in different ways because we spend a lot of time out in the Bay Area because of Golden State. You know, or in Cleveland because we're doing usually the top teams. But we did so much Chicago, and also doing the Olympics, doing the Dream Team mm-hmm. was a thrill. And guys always ask about that because that was, for many players in the NBA, that was their first memory mm-hmm. of watching basketball.
It's got to be so much different traveling on the planes in the 60s and 70s versus now, not just because of the type of planes you're traveling on, but you know what these guys were doing nowadays. It's like they're like fine-tuned machines.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, I can remember even back in the day watching Dino Raja light up cigarettes in the garden hallways.
Right.
I'm sure
right.
that happened, you know, with the drinking and smoking and just, you know, just a casual way of life.
I think guys, there weren't many guys on those Knick teams that I recall smoking. You know, I'm
European guys tend to do that more.
The European guys, yeah. Well, Vladi, Ivac, etc. But as you say, Dino, Roger. But yeah, I mean, on the buses they'd be drinking beer. Mm-hmm. There's no question, and still do, I would think.
Yeah.
Right. But the difference also is you were traveling commercial in the 70s for the most part, and there were only so many first class seats.
Mm-hmm.
So the young players or the rookies would sit. In the back, as we would,
mm-hmm.
and now it's a different story. Be as you say, be it charters or with doing one or two games a week with TNT, I'm on my own, so mm-hmm. that's okay. So you know you're going to be first class all the time. Anyway.
So you had a bird's eye view of Jordan in those days, and the subject of the comparisons come up to Jordan's teams and what we have with Golden State right now. Given what you know. What's your position on, you know, let's say that 72-win Jordan team versus the one we just saw storm through the finals against the Cavs?
It's so, not to duck it, but it's so hard to compare because the rules were different. It's much looser now. It's been made, the game has changed to be more offensively geared, which I think is good. You did not have the three-point shooting excellence that you have now. It's tough to play hard-nosed defense now. And in Jordan's era, you know, it was hand-checking and fouls were called more frequently in terms of the contact that was being made. If Jordan played now, he would definitely adapt. If LeBron played in those days, he would adapt. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's hard to go against what Michael did. Mm-hmm. It's just because of his demeanor and his desire to win. Not that LeBron or Kevin Durant or Steph Curry don't have a desire to win, but he was on another level when it came to that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that Chicago team still feels like it would be the best if you brought them into this era. And it would be a wonderful series against Golden State.
I think it's the only comparable, Marv, because I remember looking at the Lakers' numbers from 87. You mentioned the three-point shot. They averaged 5 attempts per game. This Golden State team averaged 31.
Oh, it's Houston. Like it's completely, even bad teams just fire away because the mathematics are you're better off going for the three, for the misses you're going to have from three-point territory as opposed to missing the two. I've always felt also, I mean, there were a lot of plays even in the 50s and the 60s. If they went through the same kind of conditioning and the same type of, growing up through what has taken place in basketball now, they could play, mm-hmm. Bob Cousy could play today. I mean, smaller guys because the league has expanded and you have to be pretty nifty. I mean, like an the current Isaiah Thomas, mm-hmm. and the previous Isaiah Thomas, both incredible. But you see smaller players doing well now. And guys like Cousy and Charmin would have, I think would have been all-star players if they came along at this time in terms of conditioning. Same with the Heinsohn and people like that, mm-hmm. from the old Celtic teams.
I love being around Tommy in Boston.
Oh, he's great.
He's unreal. He just has no filter.
No.
Just sitting there. I tell Mike Gorman all the time, you guys are the only tandem that can basically have a production meeting on the air. Like, you can sit
That's
there
true.
Because Tommy
That's
will just
good.
There was a Nuggets game where Tommy couldn't figure out which one was Jokic and which one was Nurkic. So he's asking Mike on the air, he's like, is that the Nurkic guy? Is that joke?
He's probably not alone in that. He would have had a good time.
But most guys would be embarrassed, right? Most guys would be like, which one's that? Which one's that? Tommy's just like, whatever.
He would have had a nice time at the Olympics.
Yeah.
Some of the teams that we did.
I can't believe Tommy was a national broadcaster in the 80s when Boston was playing in the finals. I mean, I don't really remember much about...
It wasn't a situation, as I recall, that he, every foul against the Celtics would be an argument.
No.
He didn't do that.
That's,
he was very good.
Yeah, that's different. Do you miss the... Nowadays, guys don't hate each other. Everybody's friends. They're all, texting each other after games. We've heard the story about Golden State... Players doing that. Do you miss the disdain that players from the 70s and 80s and 90s showed to their opponents? Because nowadays, it's gone. It's probably not coming back.
Do I miss the disdain?
I kind of do. I kind of wish that there was more. I remember, I just love even watching the Paul Pierce of the world walk out to center court, stand there, not tap hands with anybody. KG watching him. I like the mortal enemy.
I agree with you. Even though they say it with a smile, that Magic hated Larry Bird and the Celtics, although he loves him. And Larry said the same thing about Magic. But still, the competitive aspect of that was terrific. And you did have, as you look back, be it an Xavier McDaniel or an Anthony Mason, with that, or the Bernard King look, the stare, the game face, you don't see that frequently. And I've never thought about that. That's a good question. Mm-hmm. But yes, I do.
Well, I mean,
I do. I think people got excited when they saw LeBron and Durant, who are really friendly with each other, go at each other in terms of just a discussion. That if you say that would be going at each other, but they had to put a stop to it because I think what the league did, starting with David Stern and continuing with Adam Silver, the reason that, and I know old-timers complain about some of the technicals and some of the flagrants that are called because they do not want it to lead to worse. Mm-hmm. And they think of the Detroit, Indiana incident. And that's what the fear is, particularly in basketball, because there's no protection. And if someone punches someone, as we did see one time by accident in the Kermit Washington Rudy T incident, it can be really, really awful.
I read the book on that. I think it was called The Punch.
Terrific book.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, just reading about, you know, Rudy T tasting spinal fluid, you know, I mean, that was, you're right.
I think that's by design and probably why we don't see as much disdain, because there aren't these explosions allowed to occur that stop, because you're going to be thrown out of the game, you're going to be fined, suspended. And as we saw, even in vital type situations where, I mean, Draymond Green, that may have cost them the series last year because of the flagrant fouls.
How, I mean, speaking of the physicality and the toughness, those 90s Knicks teams, I mean, how mean and tough were they by comparison to other teams you've seen?
It's interesting to see Pat Riley, who also is one of the great coaches of all time, was able to go from finesse to
Powerball
by using Powerball would capture it by using what he had, and they were very mean, very tough. They were met by toughness too, and you remember series with Miami. But if you were a Knicks fan, you loved them, and I know there are people around the NBA who like a tough style of basketball, really enjoyed it. But there were a lot of low scoring games. There were games that, you know, I'm sure Knicks fans enjoyed it, but they were grind-out type games. That was very good. Those were very good teams also, but the style was different and the rules were different. So they could get away with that. Now these guys would be suspended, hit by technicals left and right. You know, you couldn't do that now.
Bums me out to see the bad relationship that Oakley has with the Knicks now, just because of, you know, the heart and soul that he was.
It is a shame.
Those 90s teams.
It is. And he was such a popular player, too, amongst his teammates. Fans loved him because of the way he played so fiercely. Michael Jordan was actually upset with the trade initially because he was very friendly with Charles. And he was kind of the protector of Michael in those wild games with Detroit when the Pistons were the true bad boys. And the trade was Oakley for Cartwright. Turned out Cartwright was the right piece for the Bulls because of his defense and the way, you know, setting screens, and he can also shoot. So it turned out to be a good trade for both clubs.
He was the ultimate NBA bodyguard, first for Michael, then for Patrick Ewing there. Ewing, by the way, has it surprised you that Patrick hasn't gotten a coaching opportunity?
I thought he would, and has certainly put the time in as an assistant. And I know Jeff Van Gundy loved him. Doug Collins did. They hired him, and it's really nice to see that he's getting a shot. It's tough, though, at Georgetown, because it's a little different in terms of recruiting now, in terms of the academic standards. But I think he'll eventually do well. Players will respect him. They know who he is. And, I think he's learned on the job.
Feels like there's an NBA stigma against big men, though, because Patrick is a top 50 player. You know, not a guy being handed something. He paid his dues. You know, he was an assistant coach for more than a decade with various teams and various good coaches.
I think it's similar to in baseball, where star players usually don't want to manage. They don't want to go through that. But you rarely see a star player managing. Sometimes, or maybe many times, because of their own choice. In the NBA, you don't see that many star players, come to think of it. Larry Bird was an exception. You have very good players who became coaches, but not that many star players. Patrick might be. I'm trying to think who else would be in that category when you say top 50, who then went on to, well, Magic did, but he saw it wasn't for him. Yep. He came on.
Cup of coffee.
Yeah. Right. And he didn't want to deal with that particular team.
So still enjoying all this, the travel, the job, all of it. I know you were at the Olympics recently doing that for NBC. All of it's still fun for you?
I love it. I really do. I still get excited about games. I enjoy the preparation for the games, and even enjoyed doing the boxing for NBC, which we did about 8 shows. That was a flashback for me because we did so many at NBC in the 80s and 90s. And that's, as you know, that's kind of a fun sport to do because the boxers love to talk.
Such characters.
They are. Yeah. They all have great backstories. And the big moment for them talk about the up and coming boxers, is to get on television. Mm-hmm. So they're ready to talk, and they're very, very colorful. So that's a lot of fun.
Do you have any experiences with some of the 80s greats, the Tysons or the even Ali towards the very end?
I did a number of interviews with mm-hmm. Muhammad Ali. I came after him in terms of telecasting fights. I never did a Tyson fight. My brother Steve did many of the fights that Showtime did with Tyson. But we were the era of Larry Holmes. He actually was a very good heavyweight at a time. There was nobody really to compete with him and was not that interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. I did some of Jerry Cooney's fights, but we did a lot of the good middleweight fights. Marvin Hagler, Sugar Ray, Thomas Hearns, mm-hmm. Spinks, Michael Spinks. We did a lot of those. The John the Beast Mugabe, if that name rings a bell at mm-hmm. all. So that was... that was basically the era that we did, and had a lot of good fights in the 80s. Actually.
Oh, the Four Kings era of those guys, yeah. Those middleweights. And, I saw Hagler recently. He's like living in Italy and just hanging out.
I heard he was doing spaghetti westerns at one point.
He was dressed to the nines like he was some old time gangster.
Good. Oh, really?
He was at the Garden for a Celtic game, and it's always funny to ask him about how would you. He sort of sneers when you ask about today's greats, like Mayweathers of the world. Come on, you don't want to put that guy in the ring with me. I could take him down. So, well, Marv, this has been great, man. I could do this for 2 hours. I really appreciate you coming in studio. Been looking forward to this, and thanks for doing it.
Chris, a pleasure. Thank you very much. Anytime, if we can figure it out.
We can make it work. That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Marv Albert for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you could download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.